This is a talk from BeThinking.org, which is UCCF's apologetic website. Apologetics is basically two things. It's the communication and the defence of the Christian gospel. So visit BeThinking.org soon, and make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to hear all about BeThinking.org's latest releases. I feel
okay, well, I wanted to begin by telling you the story of a vicar who was travelling on the train one day, and a scientist came along and happened to sit next to him. And the scientist was, in fact, a specialist in the field of astronomy. Well, the scientist smiled as he saw the vicar reading his Bible, a rare event in itself, you may think. And in a rather condescending manner, he said, "I like to think of religion as being summed up by the words, 'Do unto others as you would have them do unto you.'" Well, the vicar, having discovered the profession of the scientist, replied, "Yes, and I like to think that astronomy can be summed up by the words, 'Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are.'" Now, I tell that story because it seems to me to take us right to the very heart of the issue when it comes to the approach taken by the arch-atheist Oxford scientist Richard Dawkins towards religion. Far from being intellectually rigorous, I would suggest that Dawkins is not rigorous enough. Now, as we shall see, in many ways, his understanding of religion is about as shallow as our apocryphal astronomer. Now, I'd be the first to admit that within his own field of study, which is behaviorism, Professor Dawkins has an outstanding reputation. And his field of study is, in fact, behaviorism. His doctorate was on the subject of selective pecking of the domestic chick. I kid you not, that's what he did. And he later went on to study under the very famous behaviorist Conrad Lorenz. So that's his field of study. That's a speciality. Unfortunately, the rigor he uses in his scientific studies is not applied when considering his non-specialist fields, such as philosophy and religion. Now, I hope to show tonight that if Professor Dawkins were to apply some basic scientific principles to the claims of the Christian faith, then he would come to quite a different view from the one he holds at present. Now, tonight we've got the rather cheeky title, "What Would God Say to Richard Dawkins?" But it might be helpful if, first of all, we summarise what Dawkins has to say about God. And there are, in fact, four things. First of all, he claims that a Darwinian worldview makes belief in God unnecessary. And this is how Dawkins himself puts it. "Natural selection manages to explain how organisms came into being without there being any ultimate purpose. There is admittedly a strain between the thought of blind chance and design. For living beings are not only designed, they are supremely well designed, beautifully designed, and far more complicated than any man-made machine. But what is so magnificent about the Darwinian explanation is that it does manage to show how the blind forces of physics could, given sufficient time, build up these highly complicated machines." The second thing he says is that religion makes assertions which are grounded in faith, which represent a retreat from rigorous, evidence-based concern for truth. Dawkins: "Faith means blind trust in the absence of evidence, even in the teeth of evidence." Elsewhere, he says, "Faith is the great cop-out, the great excuse to evade the need to think and evaluate evidence." Thirdly, he says, "Religion offers an impoverished vision of the world. The universe presented by organized religion is a pokey, little, medieval universe, and extremely limited." Fourthly, and perhaps most controversially, he argues that religion leads to evil. And he likens it to a malignant virus infecting human minds. So in the recent program on Channel 4, The Root of All Evil, he dismisses all religious faith as an indulgence of irrationality that is nourishing extremism, division, and terror. Now, obviously, he doesn't think much of religion. You've gathered that. Now, I want to begin tonight by being overly generous to Professor Dawkins by granting, just for the sake of argument, that as a scientific explanation for the origin and development of species, Darwin's theory of evolution is correct. Just for the sake of argument. Now, many, of course, would contest this on scientific grounds, those who are not even remotely religious, especially having problems whether the timescale is large enough to account for such complexity and variety as we have it on planet Earth. There'd be people like, even Francis Crick has problems with this, and, you know, the guy who discovered DNA. And Professor Alistair Hardy, again, would say, look, the timescale is not right, so there's something more going on. But let's, just for the sake of argument, grant that the scientific theory of evolution is correct. There's still much of what follows from Dawkins does not hold up to close scrutiny. Dawkins makes many assertions which, ironically, are more of a religious or philosophical nature, which has very little to do with science. And here we come across a very important distinction which we've got to grasp. And that is the distinction between science and scientism. Now, science is a particular approach to studying certain phenomena, the physical world. So there's the looking at the data, there's the formulation of hypothesis, there's the testing and the formulation of theories and so on. That's science. Scientism is a wholesale philosophical movement, which as a matter of principle, not evidence, has no room for God or anything transcendent. Now that is a presupposition. It is not a demonstration, and it does not arise out of hard-nosed science. And it is here, in terms of his worldview or philosophy of life, that Dawkins is at his most vulnerable. And that is where you go for the attack. Now, I think it is possible to trace an increasing militancy in Dawkins against religion. Now, back in 1986, he said, "I do not think it would be possible to rule out a designing God, only that natural selection makes the idea superfluous." And then, belief in God is not incompatible with natural selection. Now, that's what he said in 1986. And there are many scientists who are Christians who would agree with that. But what we've seen in recent years is a shift taking place from Dawkins, the advocate of neo-Darwinism, to Dawkins, the religious antagonist. It's like he's on a crusade. So what is to the fore is not so much Dawkins' atheism, but his anti-theism, his anti-belief in God. So in his 1991 Royal Institution Christmas lectures, Dawkins assured his youthful audience, and remember this was going out to millions of children, that growing up in the universe also means growing out of a parochial and supernatural view of the universe, not copping out with superstitious ideas. And many people were outraged by that, even non-Christians, because they felt he was abusing his public platform. Now, a couple of years ago, Dawkins was interviewed by the Christian broadcaster and author Anne Atkins. Now, I just want to listen in to the way that interview went. And this is done very, very carefully. I'll try and get this right.
I have no particular hatred of Christians. I hate all religions, more or less equally.
I spoke to the scientist Richard Dawkins.
I think, as a scientist, supernaturalism is lazy. It teaches people the easy way out. Instead of working hard to try to understand why things work the way they do and why they are the way they are, you're served up with an easy explanation. I mean, I don't actually know what you do believe in, but an awful lot of Christians do believe, for example, in the virgin birth, believe in the resurrection, believe in the miracles, and all those beliefs seem to me to be incompatible with a scientific worldview, and they all fall foul of my laziness stricture. They all allow you to explain things in ways that are the easy way out.
And yet there are plenty of eminent, highly intelligent scientists who are Christians who do believe in those things, because although they know that they're not consistent with the way that the universe normally works, they also allow that God can make exceptions. So how do you explain
that? Well, I'm sceptical that there are all that many of them.
I can think of a number straight off. I mean, Hoggenhorn or Francis Collins or Professor Briggs of your own university or Russell Stannard. I mean, yes, one could go on
there
and
are,
on.
There are,
you know, a plenty.
I think that's very lazy and cowardly.
So you think all those eminent scientists are lazy and cowardly?
Yes, in that sense. That
it's quite a sweeping statement.
Yes, it is.
So let me press you on this. Let's take John Polkinghorne. You are saying that he imagine you wouldn't dispute the fact that he's a good scientist, but there is an area of his life where he's just simply lazy.
Well, he's a good scientist. He's
again,
a good
you know, of your kind of calibre, believes in the virgin birth, believes in the resurrection.
Yes, I mean, I'm afraid that any scientist who literally believes in the virgin birth, I cannot take seriously.
Okay, so he claims, as you heard, that it's, you know, he hates all religion. He's not prejudiced. You know, it's not just Christianity. And he said, as you've heard there, that it's not possible for any intelligent person to believe in miracles like the virgin birth. He then goes on that these miracles are nothing but conjuring tricks, like of the Uri Geller variety. And when Anne Atkins went on to point out that there were many eminent scientists, and she named quite a few of them, who did believe in such things and carried out good science, he stubbornly refused to budge. And he simply said it was impossible that they could be good scientists and believers in God. They were simply wrong. Just an assertion, no argument, just dismissed. Now, ironically, Dawkins is exhibiting all the hallmarks of those forms of religion he so despises. Vehemence, narrow-mindedness, and intolerance. In fact, you could well apply the F word to Dawkins. He is a fundamentalist of the scientific kind. So let's take a brief look at some of the main planks in Dawkins' philosophical position, and then think what God might well say to him. First of all, this business about religion being a mental virus. Now, this is the way he argued his case in a magazine called Free Inquiry. He suggested that religion is a mental virus, a false belief which infects your mind like a virus would infect your body. Look at the symptoms, he says. People don't adopt religion after carefully weighing the evidence. Faith is caught pretty much the way a cold is. And it spreads from one person to another person like an infection, especially amongst families. For those who convert, says Dawkins, an evangelist may be thought of as an infectious agent. So Lee McMahon is an infectious agent. You better keep away from him. Revivals, he says, are like epidemics of faith. And to explain this, he develops the concept of memes, M-E-M-E-S. And memes are ideas or beliefs which are analogous to genes, that is our hereditary material, in that they can replicate and they can spread rapidly, infecting people's minds. And so examples of memes are tunes, ideas, and I'm quoting Dawkins here, catchphrases, clothes, fashions, ways of making pots or building arches. Just as genes propagate themselves in the gene pool by leaping from body to body via sperm or egg, so memes propagate themselves in the meme pool by leaping from brain to brain. That's in his book, The Selfish Gene. Now, that's a very nice idea for Dawkins, but it suffers from two major setbacks. One, it is inaccurate, and two, it is self-defeating. First of all, it is inaccurate. You see, ideas are not transmitted like genes. Genes are passed on by the DNA in the chromosomes mechanically via sperm and egg. And there is little you can do about it once the reproductive process has got going. Not so with ideas. We absorb lots of ideas in all sorts of ways. And some are due to our upbringing, what we learn from our parents. But we can assess them. We can accept them. We can reject them. And we can change them. As, of course, we do throughout life. And that is why some people change religions. But you can't do that with your genetic material, can you? You have an X and Y chromosome and you're stuck with them. But you're not stuck with your beliefs. So it is a very misleading picture. But secondly, it is self-defeating. Now, apart from the fact that this concept is unscientific in that the idea cannot be proved by empirical observation or disproved by testing, like you can say for the passing on of genetic material, it's a concept which turns in on itself. So supposing there was a scientific meme, which according to Dawkins' position must be the case, does that mean that what a scientist believes, say about the composition of the air, can be discarded along the lines, well, you would think that, wouldn't you, it's your memes? Or supposing the reason why Dawkins is an atheist is because his interest in atheism was caught from a teacher when he was at school, Mr. Smedley, the atheistic scientist teacher. Does that mean what he believes about the meaningless of life and all this business about the selfish gene can be dismissed as a mere bout of having caught the atheistic flu? Of course not. See, even the idea of a meme is a result of a meme. And so, really, it is a fruitless idea. You see, how we learn about religion or to come to that any belief is a separate question from whether or not it is true. That has to be decided by looking at the evidence. But Richard Dawkins also makes the basic logical mistake in thinking that because a thing can be explained in scientific terms, no other explanation is possible or certainly not necessary. And the technical term to describe this position is reductionism. Now let me illustrate this by his description of what it means to be a human being. This is what you are. We are machines built by DNA, whose purpose is to make more copies of the same DNA. Flowers are for the same thing as everything else in the living kingdoms, for spreading copy me programs about, written in DNA language. That is exactly what we are for. We are machines for propagating DNA, and the propagation of DNA is a self-sustaining process. It is every living object's sole reason for living. That's the thing. Now, no self-respecting biologist would think of denying that biological organisms do not pass on their DNA to their offspring. But what warrants the leap from that observed fact to the assertion of faith that this is the sole reason for living? Because that is what it is. It is an assertion of faith. Not only is this counterintuitive, goes against common sense, but it goes against the visible evidence, doesn't it? People can exist for all sorts of reasons other than passing on their genetic material, promoting an ideology or a religion, producing a work of art, raising a family, and a million and one other things. You see, what Dawkins has done is to fall foul of the reductionist fallacy. That is, explaining the whole simply in terms of its constituent parts. Let me use an illustration. Imagine you've got an orchestra, and a group of scientists have been invited to study this orchestra. So physicists come along and they measure the wavelength of the notes played on the violins. Biochemists come along and they analyse the composition of the wood and the catgut, which make up the violins, and so on. And at the end of the day, they then write an exhaustive account of what they have studied, using purely scientific categories. After all, they are scientists and that's what they've been paid to do. What would not be included in their account would be words like orchestra, concerto, movement and the like. Now, no one in their right mind would deny that such things exist or have meaning. But you see, Dawkins is like the man who says that the sole reason for an orchestra's existence is the production of sounds of varying wavelengths. Now, that certainly happens, but it's not the only thing that happens, or the most meaningful thing that happens. You see, the highest description would be given not in scientific terms, but in musical terms. Now, this is what a friend of mine, the late Professor Donald Mackay, used to call nothing buttery. Man is nothing but a DNA machine. And that is a woefully inadequate description of what it means to be a human. There are higher complementary descriptions which exist too. Man is an artistic creature. Man is a moral being. Man is a fallen being. Man is a religious being. Now, they don't exclude each other, but you need all of them to give a fully orbed description of what man is, what it means to be human. But reductionists tend to be determinists as well, and Dawkins is no exception. Now, this business of looking at life solely through scientific glasses is not just an attempt to naively explain everything, but it tends to try and explain everything away. So Dawkins denies the existence of moral evil. And I quote, "In a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt. Other people are going to get lucky. And you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, or any justice. The universe we observe is precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no other good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares, and we dance to its music." Now, you know what the logical upshot of that is, don't you? That the Yorkshire Ripper danced to his own DNA. Now, can you really believe that? More to the point, can you really live with that? You certainly wouldn't have been your wife or daughter who'd been involved, would you? Now, the real irony with Dawkins is that his writings have a certain religious feel to them. Now, what I mean by that is that many religions employ the language of myth to convey their ideas. And that is exactly what Dawkins does. You see, far from his worldview arising out of hard-nosed observation of the facts, Dawkins, in effect, cheats by using the language of purpose and persons to describe things which, by his own reckoning, are impersonal and meaningless. Just listen to this and see if you can spot the semantic sleight of hand going on. He's a bit of a conjurer, is Dawkins. He says, "I shall argue that a predominant quality to be expected in a successful gene is ruthless selfishness. Like successful Chicago gangsters, our genes have survived, in some case for millions of years, in a highly competitive world and preserving our genes and their ultimate rationale for our existence. By dictating the way survival machines and their nervous systems are built, genes exert ultimate power over behavior. The gene does not grow old. It leaps from body to body down the generations, manipulating body after body in its own way for its own ends, abandoning a succession of mortal bodies before they sink in senility and death. The genes are the immortals." Okay, think of that. You see, the term selfishness is normally one applied to persons who act in ways they should not act. It is a moral category. And yet here it is inappropriately applied to particles of protein and DNA. They're described as leaping from body to body like some microscopic Superman. They're likened to Chicago gangsters as if there's a gene like Al Capone forming the mob. He speaks of them as manipulating, which again carries overtones of intentionality, characteristics of people like you and me. They're spoken of as immortals, a phrase which has a decidedly religious ring to it. Now, none of that strictly makes sense in Dawkins' worldview, but they have tremendous power. Because if Dawkins really stuck to pure scientific descriptions, then his writings would have no attraction whatsoever. Their pulling power lies in using pseudo-religious terms, and so puts his beliefs on the same level as the pagans, who spoke of Mars as the god of war, or Pluto the god of death. So he uses language of purpose and intention which properly only belong to thinking, rational agents when describing things which are not that at all. And so he cheats. He invests concepts like nature, evolution, natural selection, and chance with the abilities to choose, to build, to manufacture, to create, to design. As the philosopher Mary Midgley points out, to speak of genes as being selfish is as nonsensical as speaking of atoms as being jealous. So Dawkins has, in effect, constructed another religion in which the powers of deity have been ascribed to molecules. Now that is as big a leap of faith as anyone can make. And we are the ones who are told that we fly in the teeth of evidence. So what are we to make of Dawkins' sweeping claim that religion is a harmful? Well, first of all, it's very difficult, I think, to see where he gets the notion of harmful as moral categories of good or bad from. Where does he get these from? If we are nothing but the products of random DNA molecules, then presumably so is religion. If these are human creations, so why not accept them like you accept blue eyes and red hair? Dawkins, of course, makes a value judgment, doesn't he? That extremism and terror are bad things. Bad for whom? Not for the terrorists who get it their way and then pass on their genes to their next generation. If we live in a universe which is impersonal and we're all going to perish one day, who is to say that extremism is a bad thing? Just because Dawkins doesn't like it? But secondly, Dawkins needs to be more precise when talking about religion. That's what he does. He lumps all religions together, not bothering to note the significant differences between them. And that is as intellectually irresponsible as lumping all animals together and saying what goes for elephants in terms of their eating habits goes for ants. Patently, that is not the case. You need to look at them individually. So it is with religion. The sacrifice of live children by the Incas is not to be placed on the same level as the self-sacrifice of Christians, which led to the formation of hospitals, universities, the freeing of slaves, the rise of modern science, the protection of the unborn, and the care of the elderly. Goods by anyone's reckoning. What you've got to do is to look at what God is being, what type of God is being presented by the religion, and you will see what will follow. If it is believed, as by the Romans, that the gods are indifferent to what human beings do, they couldn't care less, then morality will be separated from religion, and the barbarity of the gladiators and the arenas will follow. But if you believe, as Christians do, that there's only one God, he is passionately concerned about the world he has made and holds us responsible, then that will make a big difference to the way you live, and history bears that out. Dawkins, you see, seems to prefer to do a Nelson and turn a blind eye to such uncomfortable facts and damn all religions in the same way. But is it really true to say that faith is blind? A blind trust in the teeth of the evidence. So let me tell you what I think God would say to Richard Dawkins, as he would say to you and me tonight. On the basis of what God says about himself in his book, the Bible, the Scripture, I think he'd say this: Richard, I commend your professed passion for the truth. In your scientific endeavours, you want to get things straight. You want to deal with things as they are and not kowtow to the way people might want things to be. Wishful thinking has no place in my world any more than it does in your world. Now, I commend this because I too am a God who is committed to truth. I too am dead straight. The prophet says, Lord, from your mouth is the truth. I, the Lord, speak the truth. Jeremiah exclaims, do not your eyes look for truth? Now, of course, it follows that I am a God who is opposed to all kinds of falsehood and incorrect thinking too. When I came to earth in the person of my son, Jesus Christ, you would not find anyone more passionate for the truth and intolerant of religious humbug than he. In Matthew's Gospel alone, there are 31 times when Jesus said to his audience, I tell you, the truth. And because of my commitment to the truth, I would like to challenge your commitment to ask if you have been so honest and above board in your dealings with the evidence as you should have been. First, you've engaged in muddled thinking, which is really not becoming a man of your intellectual abilities, which I have actually given to you. For instance, you claim, and I quote, that religion is a scientific theory, and I see God as a competing explanation for the facts about the universe and life. And God and natural selection are, after all, the only two workable theories we have of why we exist. Now, Richard, you well know that a scientific theory seeks to explain natural phenomena in terms of antecedent causation, relating events to earlier events and extrapolating into the future. That is like a literary scholar studying a play of Shakespeare and seeing how one character relates to another and how the plot develops. That's fine. But you seem to be making the mistake of saying that because you can't see me in the creation, I don't exist, or that natural selection can replace me. But that is like a literary critic saying that because he cannot see Shakespeare in Hamlet, Shakespeare doesn't exist. No, the Bible, you see, is concerned with explaining the whole drama, why it is there at all, rather than giving detailed explanations as to the way the world works. Religion is an alternative to your scientism, not science. In fact, if you bothered to do your homework, Richard, you would soon discover that it was the Judeo-Christian faith which gave rise to modern science, because it proceeded on the assumption, based on my revelation in the Bible, that an intelligent, orderly, good God created an orderly world which is open to investigation. More than that, going back to Genesis 1, which you so despise, I expect you to look into that world. I expect you to explain the world I have made and to tame it and to use its resources for the good. In fact, you're meant to be a good steward. And to be frank with you, Richard, if it were not for the religion you are so intent on discrediting, you would be out of a job. Secondly, as a scientist, you are meant to examine carefully all the evidence at your disposal and not be selective, taking only that which fits with your preferred theory. Fact is king. So if a theory does not do justice to the data, so much worse for the theory, you change it. You know, some of my followers wrote whole books jam-packed full of evidence for people like you to investigate, with an open mind, of course. And they're called Gospels. Indeed, Luke was one of your own. He was a doctor. And he said that he had carefully, painstakingly investigated everything about Jesus. Ask yourself, who is this person, Jesus? What hypothesis best does justice to the data? Any theory has to be coherent. It's got to hang together well. It's got to explain fully what it is dealing with. And it's meant to be fruitful, generating new insights. The Gospels do that. How else do you explain Jesus' magnificent words and sayings? Someone said these. And what about the miracles, which are not of the Uri Geller variety you claim, which is so trivial? Healing the sick, raising the dead. These people weren't simpletons, you know. They knew when a person was dead and had come alive again. These are not tricks, but signs, and signs which point to something significant, that God in Jesus has come to earth to start putting things right. Tell me, how do you explain the fulfillment of the books written over a 1,000-year period called the Old Testament, which all point to Jesus? Does Jesus really strike you as mad? Or a liar? And what of the resurrection? You know, Jesus had a follower who was a hard-nosed skeptic like you. He was called Thomas. And he wanted hard data. Unless he could touch and see him, he would not believe. You can't get any hard-nosed than that. Well, he got it when the resurrected Jesus appeared to him and he fell down at Jesus' feet and said, "My Lord and my God." You see, all the data is there for you to look at. It's cumulative. It's weighty. Why do you think that there are thousands of eminent scientists around the world who are Christians? Are you really honestly saying they're copping out? Isn't that a mite arrogant? Might that not be a charge which can be laid right at your doorstep, Richard? But one final word. Richard, you know that not all truth can be had from standing at a distance like a behaviorist. Some truth can only be had by personally being involved, like the love of a person. Jesus said, if you hold to my teaching, you will really be my disciples, then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. One of the big weaknesses of your belief system, and it is a belief system, Richard, is that it has no room for human dignity and human failure. I affirm men and women because in their value, because they're made in my image. And even you, Richard, reflect something of me. It must be a pain to you, but that's what is the case. But you see, I'm also open-eyed to human failure. I call it sin. And my son came into the world to sort that out, to enable you to see that this universe is much bigger than you can imagine, that there's nothing pokey about it at all, that in fact there are not only physical dimensions, there's also spiritual dimensions to this universe. There is a heaven to gain and there is a hell to be avoided. There is a world to come and a judgment. And my son died for you so that you could be forgiven and you could know me personally and live the way you were intended to. So why not look at all the evidence for yourself? More to the point, why don't you have courage, the guts to follow it through the very end? After all, isn't that the scientific thing to do? Okay, let me take questions. I mean, I've covered quite a lot of material there. Some of it will be new to you. But anyway, it's given you some idea. Any questions for this? Martin.
But it's really a question about biblical authority, Melvin. A lot of your evidence tonight, understandably, and as Christians, obviously, we would agree and support that, comes from the Bible itself.
Mm.
But what do you say to someone who says, I know that if I accept that the Bible's true, then everything else follows from that, and all my evidence can come from that.
Mm.
But what do you say to someone who's searching for the truth, genuinely?
Yeah.
I've got quite a few friends who are like that. They're very genuinely open and searching for the truth.
Mm.
But they say, but how do I know that the Bible is true? Is there any evidence for God, in a sense, by looking outside the Bible?
Yeah. Well, there is, but let me say the way I would tackle it. I'd say, look, you don't have to come... Let's just take with the New Testament. Let's start off with, say, Mark's Gospel or whatever. You don't have to come believing the Bible to be God's Word or divine revelation or anything. Let's just start off with Mark's Gospel, say, as a historical document. And just, you know, look at it on that basis. And there are lots of reasons, arguments you could also give to show that it is a historical document, it's dating... It's corroborated with other archaeological evidence. It fits in with the historic times and so on. So just do that. You don't have to believe it's religious. God's got nothing to do with it. It's just historical. Let's have a look at this person. Let's have a look at his life. Let's have a look at his claims. And just by looking at this, you know, then, you know, in a sense, be scientific and just say, well, look, what sort of model, what sort of theory or hypothesis can I put forward which will explain this phenomenon called Jesus Christ and then the rise of this movement called the Christian movement, the church? And you know, you can try lots of different ones, but any theory has got to fulfill certain criteria. Any theory, it doesn't matter if it's a scientific theory, historical theory, it's got to be coherent, it's got to hang together. It's got to be consistent. There's not got to be internal contradictions. It's got to be congruent. That is, it's got to deal with the real world. It's got to be comprehensive. That is, it's got to deal with all the evidence. And you can't say, well, I don't like that bit. You know, I don't like miracles. I don't believe in miracles. Wait, hang on. You know, that is being presented. How else do you explain it? And then the final test is that is, it, you know, you've got to be able to be committed to it. It's got to be lived out. You've got to live with it. And this is the point I would say about someone like Dawkins, is that he is not consistent. He's committed to his beliefs in theory, but he doesn't act as if it was so. And I'll give you an example of that, that he does deny the existence of moral evil, and yet a few years ago, he, together with a few other scientists, wrote a letter to The Guardian complaining about the Jewish treatment of the Palestinians. Now, whether we agree with them or not, there's an irrelevance. The point is, he is making a moral claim. Where does he get that from? Now, what I would say is then, just ask people, look at the evidence. And that's the way I began. I wasn't a Christian, I was an atheist. And I had no time for religious humbug. But I just started, I thought, okay, I'll give it a whirl. I'll have a look at this. And then I came to the point after many months of not just reading the Bible, but other books around it, of saying, look, this is the best explanation, its own explanation, that Jesus is who he claimed to be, God who became man. That's the way I would argue it. Yeah.
What would you say to people who've got real hang-ups about all the religious wars at the centre of the earth, particularly the Christian ones?
Well, I don't want to veer too much from Dawkins, although it is the sort of thing he's claiming about religion being evil and wars. And I'd simply say that is not true. People talk about the Crusades. Okay. But again, you've got to look at the source, you know, the basic religious documents, which is the New Testament. And Jesus, says, he who lives by the sword will die by the sword. The early Christians did not join the Roman army, you know, on basic principles and so on. And it is clearly a religion of peace. This is Lee's subject, but when you look at the Quran and you do not find that, you've got justification for war and violence. So they're being consistent with the Quran. Christians who depart from what the Bible says are being inconsistent. And also that they're fallen people. And sometimes, when you look at it historically, some of these things are political, not religiously motivated. But then I would go to the 20th century and say, what produced the main the genocides? Atheism. Whether it's that of National Socialism, whether it's Stalin's gulags, whether it's Pol Pot killing a third of the Cambodians. That wasn't religion producing those murders, it was atheism. And that is a fact, and that is the consistency of atheism, I would say. Or at least you can go that way and you can't argue against it. So that would be, I'd go back on the offensive on that one, actually. Other questions?
Would he have any ideas about the history of science? I mean, you have given the explanation of the rise of Judeo Christianity.
Yeah.
Would he, presumably he wouldn't accept that, but would he have an alternative explanation?
I mean, what surprises me in some way that someone can be so bright and yet so dumb in some ways, I have to say. I mean, it's shocking. And it seems to me that for whatever reason, he's not bothered to look at that. And, you know, on the interview with Ann Atkins, she reels off a whole load of these scientists, and what they just dismiss is if they don't exist. Well, that is not the way you deal with data. You've got to explain that. And if you read, there's loads of books which will bear this out in terms of the rise of science. That is simply a historical fact. Oppenheimer, the guy who devised the atomic bomb, who was from a Jewish background and then became pretty well Hindu, he said you cannot explain the modern science without Christianity. A.N. Whitehead, who wrote the Principia Mathematica with Bertrand Russell, an atheist, says exactly the same. And so these aren't people who've got an axe to grind, they're just simply object. These are scientists, but then there are plenty of other historians. There's one called Rodney Stark over at Washington University, has written several books at the moment, very weighty books, and he's argued that exactly the same. You cannot understand Western culture, you cannot understand modern science without Christianity. It is the rocket that launched it. So anyway, yeah. But I don't know why he's not bothered looking at it. John?
Don't you find it astonishing that the behaviourists haven't looked at behaviour?
Yes, indeed. Yes, yes. This is the oddity. And
one of the things about Christianity which makes it ring is the behaviour of people over the centuries.
Yes, that's right.
I would have thought that this would have been the most obvious evidence for a behaviourist to look at.
I know. But this, again, shows, doesn't it, that we're not all, you know, including scientists, we're not impartial, objective. You know, we will go wherever the facts lead us. We're not cool in that. We people have agendas, and the sad thing I think about Dawkins is very able. He's very, obviously, as we said, and a good communicator. Seems to just be driven. He's a driven man, and one wants to know why. I know he's been challenged, for instance, by Professor Alistair McGrath at Oxford University for a public debate. He's refused every time. And I thought, well, hang on, you know, if you're really convinced, you know, it's all right talking to kids at the Christmas lectures, but, you know, why don't you be fair dues and come against someone of equal intellectual stature as you? You know, otherwise it's like, you know, Muhammad Ali, you know, punching somebody from the primary school, you know, I mean, that's cheap. And if he's so convinced of his position, he's so confident, then why not go head to head, as it were, with somebody else who could put a different point of view? I mean, why not? You know. Yeah.
One of the things, as you now mentioned, was the fact that he said that this religion in its genes works in all the whole family, that all families become religious.
But it's obviously not so.
Because my mother had 9 children, and I'm the only Christian.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, this is John's point, isn't it, about behaviourism? Look at the evidence, and it's patently not the case. So it's a shame, really. I said it's disappointing too. I think it's very disappointing. I'm sure God would say to that, "Look, you're a very bright man. You know, why don't you go with the evidence?" But it's not just Dawkins, is it? I mean, we're all like it, aren't we? You know, we can easily, you know, all have blinkers. And God doesn't want us to be like that. He wants us to go with the truth, because he's a God who's dead straight. Sorry, Pete.
It's a good question. I've been asked, like, you're talking about evidence and so on, like, how much of a leap of faith have you taken to believe in God and in Jesus Christ? Like, how much is that a leap of faith?
I wouldn't call it a leap of faith. It's a step of faith. You see, when people talk about leaps of faith, I mean, that links into existentialism and stuff like that. And usually it's prefaced by a blind leap of faith. You know, as if you come to a cliff and you don't know anything's there. And you know, it's like, the Last Crusade, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, you know, going across the valley and, you know, there's this invisible bridge there. That is not the way it happens. And that is not the way, I mean, certainly my experience and most of the people I know have become Christians. They look at the evidence. But there comes the point, when we talk about faith, what do we mean? Well, we mean, is something trustworthy? Can I put my trust in this person or this theory or the data? That's what we're saying. And so, you know, so you want to be convinced. But there comes a point, this is why I sort of made the point at the end, that not all knowledge can be had from a distance. You know, if one were a bit, you know, coming back to being a behaviourist, the point of a behaviourist is that they can, like a lot of, it's sort of one of those things which sort of borders over a bit with social science, that there's got to be a fair distance between the observer and that which they're observing, because if they interfere too closely, then they upset, you know, the chickens or whatever it is, and so it upsets the, you know, the outcome and the data and everything else. It's skewed. So you've got to be, take a step back as far as you can, to allow them to operate within their natural environment without interfering. That's fine when you're looking at selective pecking in chickens. But when you're dealing, say, with the love of a woman, I mean, you know, if Dawkins, well, he's been married a few times, but it may not have nothing to do with it, but, you know, you can't treat your wife in that sort of way. She won't be your wife for very long. She wouldn't have been your wife in the first place. There comes that point where, you know, there's that personal involvement. where you give yourself over to the person, where you take the step of the faith, and then once you do that, you then see things differently. And it's like that becoming a Christian. I always say to people, you don't accept just what we say, look at it for yourself. We'll help you look at it. Look at the Mark's Gospel, look at Christian books which will explain the evidence for the resurrection and all that sort of thing. But there comes that point when all the evidence has been put to you and you've got to make a decision. Christianity isn't just a take it or leave it thing, because there's so much at stake. And it's a personal relationship. And so there comes a point when you've weighed the evidence, it makes sense, yeah, Jesus seems to be who he is, but it has to become personally real. Like, going out with a woman, you get to know them and you have a courting period, and eventually it comes to that point where you say, well, will you marry me? It's still a bit of a risk, is this right, etc., etc. Of course there's a risk, but it's not blind faith. There's good reasons to come to that point of trusting that Jesus is who he says he is, and we're called to follow him.
And more to the point, the behaviour that follows from it makes it true.
Yeah, and that it corroborates it. That's right, it corroborates. What follows then, the change that takes place, corroborates the thing. And if there is no change in our lives, then we've not really become Christians. Yeah, that's right. Colin?
You just use the word corroborate. I just wonder about that, what Martin was saying. I thought the Bible was self-sufficient as regards containing evidence for the authenticity of God, but apparently the friends we've been talking about, the problem is that they want corroboration from God. So where is this coming from?
Yeah, well, in one sense, yeah, I mean, the Bible is self-sufficient if we want to know God, what he is like, what his purpose is for us. It's all there contained in this book. But like with a lot of things, there are, as I say, corroborative or other pieces of evidence which give it a bit more, if you like, weight. For some, that is sufficient. But others, they say, well, are there other things? And you say, yeah, there are. I mean, there's lots of historical references to Jesus and so on, Tacitus and Pliny and all these other things, Josephus. So it's not just that this is a historical book. There are other historical books around this historical book which sort of feed it. And then there are other things in, it's in the psalm, taste and see that the Lord is good. There comes that point where you've got to personally take it. And, I often say, I could describe sugar to you. I could give you the chemical formulas of sugar, honestly. I could talk about the texture of a sugar cube. But at the end of the day, the only way, and I can say I've tasted it, it's sweet. There are lots of other people who have tasted it, it is sweet. The only way you're going to know whether it's sweet is if you taste it yourself. And I would suspect that there are people here tonight, for whatever they say, there may be an intellectual assent to Christianity and saying, yeah, it's a good thing. But you're not Christians. And you're not a Christian because you've not taken that step of commitment, of surrendering your life to someone who can handle your life better than you can. And that's what some of you guys need to do, I have to say that. We'll take one more. Was that a good one to end on? It's a good one to end on. Okay, I'm quite happy to talk about things further. May I also say, talking about evidence and so on, I've got some books with me about the life of Jesus, the historical reliability of the Bible. If you're really, if you're searching, want to know more, then have a word with me and I can give you one of these afterwards. Okay? Great. Well, thank you very much. Okay.